Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 19th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Carmen Rita Bovee, Vicky Bratcher, Thomas G. Frost, Jr., Shirley Hansen, Sylvia Gans Houle, known as Sis, William Joseph Engler, Beverly Mintha Camps, Pat Minity, Norma A. Padres, Tracy A. Donahoe Rasick, Richard C. Tamburino, known as Rick, Charlie Valenzuela, Andre DeLille Volner. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. We turn now to the economy section of the paper. There's just one article in this section. It's a fairly long one, though. It's three columns wide. What does it take to be a top 1% earner? This was written by Madeline Mitchell for the USA Today. Working in tech, Nancy Marzouk was used to being the only woman in the room, but that doesn't mean she liked it. Marzouk, who is 52, said, "I felt like I constantly overperformed, yet was under potentially more scrutiny than other people, if that makes sense." She had gone to school for fine arts, but fell into advertising after undergrad and grew to love the industry. And as she rose in the ranks at various marketing and tech agencies, she felt like she was always working harder than the people around her, but wasn't moving up the ladder at the same rate. She said the companies weren't going to change. I had to leave to change it, basically. That's how I felt. I felt like I'd gotten to the point in my career where it wasn't about what I did. There was too much politics at play. And so if you weren't part of that, like, boys' club, then it didn't matter what I did. Marzouk took a risk. She left her stable corporate job and launched her own startup, Media Walla. That's MediaWallah, all in one word. It's a data management company back in 2013. Now, Marzouk makes between $600,000 and $800,000 every year, placing her in the top 1% of income earners in the country, according to Smart Asset. Among the top 1% of income earners in the United States, only 5% of them are women, according to an American Sociological Review study from 2019. Emily Riley, another woman in the top 1% and a researcher, recently surveyed 145 of these women to find out what it takes to be a woman in the top 1%. Another 180 women surveyed in the report earn more than $300,000, and about 170 other women surveyed make between $100,000 and $300,000. Now, ranges vary slightly, but for Riley's study, the top 1% income earners make more than $775,000 a year. Women are well represented in top 1% households as wives and partners to high-earning men, but women themselves are rarely the sole earners in top 1% households. Riley, who is 48, said, quote, "What I realized sort of in my mid-career as I started having children and I wanted more flexibility is that I really didn't have the tools to negotiate it in a way where I felt like I was in control. I always felt as though I was one step behind. I was missing out on something. And while I continued to be reasonably successful, it just made it obvious to me that there weren't a lot of women above me who had created a path that I could follow," unquote. So Riley took a risk as well, after she decided to have a third child. She wanted more flexibility as a working mom, so she became a technology consultant. Like Marzouk, she found that being her own boss actually led to more income for her and her family. She said she makes just under $1 million a year. Most of the talk around women in the workforce focuses on challenges and hurdles, Riley said. She thought about how, as a younger working woman, she had always wished for a roadmap to success. So she went after her own research, tapping successful women in her network, in women's groups, and across LinkedIn. She said, "I was overwhelmed by the positive feedback. It really seemed to touch a nerve that other career women agreed with me, you know. This is something we would all enjoy. Instead of just feeling annoyed or frustrated or challenged, we can actually do something about it and be really excited to hear each other's stories and to learn from one another." Well, the results of Riley's survey found that there are three traits that women in the top 1% share: drive, career management, and a willingness to learn and grow. But she also found women in the 1% are less compliant and are more willing to go their own way. 1 in 5 women in the 1% are likely to go with the flow versus 1 in 3 women in lower income brackets. Most women in the top 1% of income earners are married and have children. While these women are usually the primary breadwinners of their households, 89% are married, 71% have 2 or more children. Marzouk has 2 boys. Her husband works, but she has been the primary breadwinner for her family for a while now. Earlier in her career, she said she felt like she had to go above and beyond at work, or else it would impede my ability to climb up the corporate ladder. Well, her partner was instrumental to her success, she said, by being supportive and encouraging her to follow her dreams and goals. Now, things have gotten better for working moms in recent years, Marzouk said, but she still feels like she missed a lot of things when her kids were little. Riley said she heard a lot about guilt from the women that she interviewed for this research. "There are not many women who are CEOs in tech," Marzouk said, "and even fewer founders." She gets excited when she hears about women who are looking to start their own company in the advertising and technology space, and she wants to help them. "Raising capital funds as a woman is difficult," she said. She said, quote, "Women are very pragmatic, like we think of things realistically," unquote. But being realistic with financial projections does not excite potential funders, who are mostly men. She said, "People only want to invest in the pipe dream." Well, her advice? Think like a man. Quote, "What would a man do? What would my husband do if he was in this situation? And I actually do the opposite of what my gut is telling me because I know who my audience is," unquote. A lot of women are stuck in mid-tier roles, Marzouk said. Sometimes, she said, women need to think about what they want to accomplish and the best way to get there, which might mean getting out of their comfort zone. "Once you break through the grass ceiling," Marzouk said, "you can do whatever you want to do." And that was Madeline Mitchell's role covering women and the caregiving economy at USA Today. And it's from the article, "What Does It Take to Be a Top 1% Earner?" We're coming up on 9 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section now. On the front page of the sports section, everything is all about the upcoming NFL draft occurring later on this week. So, the cover story is by Bob McManaman, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, "Ossenfort Cards Cannot Afford to Fumble This Draft." Look, we know you bought yourself some time and avoided the trap door straight into the shark-infested tank that swallowed up your former head coach, Jonathan Gannon. But given the outright release of quarterback Kyler Murray that everyone and their sister saw coming months ago, you should not feel comfortably numb in any way, shape, or form. If anything, you should be quaking in your Florsheim shoes, or whatever your footwear preference happens to be right now. Because that's because, in addition to eventually finding a new franchise quarterback, whether it's now or later, you've got to absolutely nail this draft. And Monty, let's be honest, Your first 3 years as GM in charge of the Cardinals draft have not been splendid. Don't get me started about your predecessor, Steve Keim, but if you aren't careful about what you do next, you could be on the verge of joining him as persona non grata among a segment of the Cardinals' faithful. You have made 29 picks to date. By my conservative count, you appear to have hit on just 4 of them. In 2023, there was left tackle Paris Johnson Jr., defensive back Garrett Williams, and wide receiver Michael Wilson. In 2024, none. And in 2025, cornerback Will Johnson. Now, in fairness, there is still a decent chance you might have hit a jackpot on last year's first-round pick, defensive tackle Walter Nolan III, but we need to see a whole lot more from him after he was limited to just 6 games due to a calf injury and a knee issue that ended his season. In the meantime, please do better. You and the Cardinals have the number 3 overall pick this year. If you keep it, that is, after finishing 3-14 and putting most of us to sleep in 2025 again, your fan base and I need a wake-up call in the worst of ways this time around, Monty. And you, your scouting staff, your new head coach, Mike LaFleur, and yes, your team owner, Michael Bidwell, cannot afford to fumble this opportunity. Your job security and the Cardinals' current and future season ticket holders depend on it. The task obviously goes well beyond whatever you're able to pull off in the first round, but let's start there. Even though your team also has the second pick in round number 2, that's number 34 overall, and the first pick in round number 3, that's number 65 overall, but knowing you, Monty, it wouldn't be a surprise if you orchestrate a trade down to pick up additional draft capital, as you did 3 years ago when you drafted Johnson Jr. Speaking of which, thanks for finally exercising his fifth-year option on April 16th, ahead of the May 1st deadline. A big fat contract extension next would serve him and the franchise far better, but you probably already know that. In case you're still scrolling, though, let's talk about your options if you stick with the 3rd overall pick. Former Texas Tech edge rusher David Bailey, who tied for the FBS lead in sacks with 14.5 this past season, is intriguing. He would be a disruptive force to pair with last year's free agent addition, Josh Sweat. From what I'm hearing, though, he'll likely will go to New York Jets with the 2nd overall pick. Everyone knows the Cardinals needs a new starting right tackle opposite Johnson, and Francis Magua from Miami appears to be a viable option. That's only if he's really suited to play tackle in the NFL and not get bumped inside to guard. It's debatable whether he's worth the number 3 pick this year. I suppose you guys could roll the dice on a top prospect like Arvell Reese, the athletic linebacker and edge rusher out of Ohio State. But after witnessing the unimpressive displays by former Keim draft picks like Deion Buchanan and Haason Reddick and Isaiah Simmons, yes, even Zaven Collins, I'm not sure we're all willing to stomach another failed first-round hybrid-type experiment. And that leaves you with one more option, Monty, and it's the best of the bunch. You stick and pick the best player available, who just happens to be a running back, Jeremiah Love from Notre Dame. Draft him and never look back. We know you're bringing back James Conner on a 1-year restructured deal, and you have acquired free agent Tyler Algier on a 2-year contract, but Love is the answer. The Heisman Trophy finalist rushed for 1,372 yards and 18 touchdowns this past season, and he would not only fit right in with LaFleur's offense, but put fans back in the seats at State Farm Stadium. Love would sell jerseys and season tickets and take some of the heat off you while you figure out what to do about finding your next franchise quarterback. You can wait until next year's draft for that if you choose. But drafting Ty Simpson from Alabama this year, either with pick number 34 or by making a deal for a late first-round pick, it works for me. Love and Simpson would be a win-win, Monty. Your new coach would be happy. So would Cardinals fans. Just think how powerful young playmaking running back could help your veteran bridge quarterbacks Jacoby Brissett and Gardner Minshew. Love would make Simpson's life a lot easier, too, when the quarterback is ready to play, assuming you draft them both. Make it happen, Monty. You and the Cardinals cannot afford to screw this up. And that was the article, Ossenfort Cards Cannot Afford to Fumble This Draft. Our next article is about NBA basketball, and it's entitled, What to Expect as Suns Face Thunder in Round 1, written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic, coming from Oklahoma City. The Phoenix Suns did not squander their final chance to make the playoffs. They took care of business, topping the Golden State Warriors 111-96 on April 17th in the final NBA play-in tournament game for the 8th seed in the Western Conference playoffs, before a sellout crowd of 17,071 at Mortgage Matchup Center. Suns coach Jordan Ott said after the game, quote, "That group that's in that locker room has a ton of resilience and wants to do things different. And that's what we stress from the get-go. Sometimes the road's not always the one that you choose and think it's going to happen, or the one that's most traveled. Sometimes it's the least traveled," unquote. The Suns bounced back from losing on April 14th to Portland for the 7th seed to top the Warriors and return to the playoffs after falling short last season. Jalen Green delivered a second straight 30-point game Friday night, this time on Friday going for 36 points, tying a career high for made three-pointers in a game with 8 of them. Green said, quote, super fun, especially with the way we were playing, ball flying around, playing defense. We were finding each other, getting steals, getting out and running. That's when we're at our best," unquote. Phoenix bottled up Stephen Curry, limiting the superstar to just 17 points and fully exploiting Golden State's mistakes by scoring 30 points off of 21 Warriors turnovers. And there was a literal parting shot after the game, courtesy of Draymond Green, who appeared to punch Devin Booker in his midsection as Booker passed the ball while crossing half court. That led to a heated verbal exchange, and Green being ejected to a chorus of boos with 1:04 left in the game. Booker was also ejected. Booker said, quote, "It's nothing, man. I've been there before. I understand the situation. My big brother used to beat me in NBA Live back in that day, and I'd throw a fit. He's a competitor. He loves the sport," unquote. Well, goodbye, Warriors. Hello, defending NBA champions. The Suns opened Game 1 of their first-round series on Sunday, April 19th, against the Oklahoma City Thunder at Paycom Center. Suns forward Dylan Brooks, when asked about facing the top overall seed in the playoffs, quote, "Driving, good shooting, they're physical, and they play. It's going to be a battle," unquote. So here's a breakdown of the Suns' upcoming playoff series. Number 8, Phoenix Suns, with a record of 45-37, versus the number 1 Oklahoma City Thunder, whose record is 64-18. Game 1 is Sunday, April 19th, 12:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, Paycom Center on ABC. Game 2 will be on April 22nd, 6:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, at Paycom Center on ESPN. Game 3 will be on April 25th, at 3:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time at Mortgage Matchup Center, and it will be on NBC and Peacock. Game 4 will be on April 27th, and the time is to be determined, but it will be at Mortgage Matchup Center. And they haven't decided yet on which TV channel it will be broadcast on. And if necessary, there will be a Game 5 on April 29th back on Paycom Center. And if necessary, a Game 6 on May 1st at Mortgage Matchup Center. And if necessary, a final Game 7 will be on May 3rd at Paycom Center. And all of those are listed as to be determined. So, what to watch? Well, the secret is out. Do you remember back in November when Booker candidly talked about the Thunder's approach to defense? This is what he said. Quote, the secret is out. They do speed you up. They play aggressive. They'll grab. They'll hold. But it's never like when you're in a shooting position. It's always on the handle or on your drives when they get away with it. Unquote. The Thunder finished the regular season first in the NBA in defensive rating for a second straight season, but seventh in the league in fouls committed at 19 a game. So two things can be true. How Phoenix handles Oklahoma City's pressure defense with that grabby element will greatly impact the series. Defending the reigning MVP, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he is the NBA's hardest player to defend because he plays with a consistent pace. He has controlled handles, an assortment of moves and counters, and he can draw fouls like no one ever has in the history of this game. He finished fourth in the league in free throw attempts at 9 per game after averaging 8.8 last season to rank third. The Suns likely will start the series with Jordan Goodwin defending Gilgeous-Alexander. Goodwin led a special defense effort against Curry, who shot just 4 of 16 from the field, going only 3 of 10 on three-pointers. Goodwin matched his career high in steals with 6. Goodwin said, quote, taking on whatever matchup I got, just trying to do my best to make it difficult out there, unquote. Goodwin won't be the only one defending Gilgeous-Alexander, but he'll be called upon to set a defensive tone against the NBA's toughest player to defend. On the lineups, well, Ott may be without center Mark Williams early in this series after he missed Friday's game with left foot soreness. He recently sat out 15 consecutive games with left foot third metatarsal stress reaction. Grayson Allen was available Friday after missing time with a left hamstring strain, but he didn't play in missing a third consecutive game. So the availability of Williams and Allen will impact who Ott plays and how the Suns play against the NBA's best team. But he will have Jalen Green for the first time this season against the Thunder because Green missed all of the regular season matchups. And that was the article by Dwayne Rankin, What to Expect as Suns Face Thunder in Round 1. Our next article from the interior of the sports section is about Diamondbacks baseball. Soroka picks up fourth win in 4 starts. This article was written by Nick Pecoro and Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. The two defining moments of the Diamondbacks' 6-3 series opening win over the American League champion Toronto Blue Jays on Friday, April 17th, came at crucial times in the game. Both went the way of the Diamondbacks in the late innings and led to the team's 7th win in the past 9 games. Right-hander Michael Soroka, the first-ever Canadian-born Diamondbacks pitcher to face the Blue Jays, allowed just 2 runs on 5 hits with 5 strikeouts over 7 innings for his 4th win in 4 starts this season. With the tying run on third base and 2 outs in the 7th, Soroka ended his night with a 90-mile-per-hour cutter for a strikeout of the Blue Jays' Ernie Clement. Soroka said, quote, it was kind of a cat-and-mouse game, but ultimately we were going to go down with our best stuff. Again, just pick the pitch and absolutely let it rip. Don't leave anything on the table. It felt good to get the result there at the end, unquote. Soroka said being 4-0 has as much to do with the play of his teammates as what he's been able to do. The Diamondbacks, that were up 3-2 at that point, gave Soroka some insurance runs in the bottom of the 7th inning. A two-out throwing error by Blue Jays first baseman Vladimir Guerrero Jr. allowed Jose Fernandez to reach base and Ketel Marte to score. And then Nolan Arenado singled in Corbin Carroll for a three-run lead. And that was enough for the Diamondbacks' bullpen to hold on to the lead, helped by the other key moment of the night, a fortunate hop to turn a double play in the top of the eighth inning. Miles Straw hit the ball up the middle with runners on first and second, but second baseman Ildemaro Vargas could not field the ball cleanly. He somehow bobbled the ball into the hands of shortstop Geraldo Perdomo, who was coming across second base. Perdomo got the force out at second and threw to first to get two big outs. Arenado said that was an unbelievable play. Vargy keeping it in front, but Perdomo with just the instinct to be there and make that play was unbelievable. That was awesome. Really impressed with him and how he goes about his business over there. It's been fun playing with him on the left side. The Blue Jays got a run against reliever Jonathan Lasega in the inning, but nothing more. Tim Tawa's RBI double added another run, and closer Paul Sewald finished it in the ninth with his seventh save of the year. Arenado and Marte had two hits each for the Diamondbacks, whose record is now 12-8. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovullo said, quote, "Really good day for him, Soroka, and it set everything up for us to have another semi-low scoring win. We all played defensively. Just a game that we enjoy playing. We seem to live in that space, and it was another really good, exciting win for us," unquote. Soroka had not pitched seven innings in a game since back on August 22, 2019, with Atlanta. Carroll and Fernandez delivered run-scoring singles in the fifth inning, and Arenado's third home run this week gave the Diamondbacks that 3-1 lead. But a Straw home run leading off the sixth inning cut the advantage to 7-2. Arenado took Blue Jays reliever Eric Lauer deep to left field for a solo homer in the fourth inning. Lauer was originally going to start the game, but came on after one inning. Carroll brought home Jorge Barroso with his single, Carroll's team-high 12th run batted in of the season. And with two outs, Fernandez delivered, driving in Marte. The in-game interaction between close friends and stars like Marte and Guerrero made for entertainment. In the bottom of the first inning, Marte hit a hard line drive headed for right field, only to have Blue Jays first baseman Guerrero make a diving catch to his right to rob Marte of a hit. Marte could only smile at fellow Dominican Guerrero, who grinned in return. The fun between the two World Baseball Classic teammates continued. Marte grounded out to third in the bottom of the third and playfully chased Guerrero after he caught the throw across the diamond. Arenado, in his past five games, is hitting .368, 7-19, with nine runs batted in. Lovullo said, quote, "He's just got a really good, consistent contact point. He's back in a good hitting position. He's finally balanced out the top and bottom half of his body to where he knows where that ball is going to be, and the swing is matching everything," unquote. Now, Lourdes Gurriel Jr.'s abbreviated rehab assignment with AA or Amarillo is finished after two games, and the Diamondbacks' left fielder is on the verge of returning far sooner than anyone anticipated from his right ACL surgery that he had last September. At the time of the procedure, it seemed possible that Gurriel might not make it back until sometime in the middle of the season. Instead, he could be back after just 20 games. Lovullo told SiriusXM on Friday morning, April 17th, that Gurriel's return was imminent. It does not appear likely to happen ahead of their series opener against the Toronto Blue Jays, but it could come on Saturday, April 18th. And that was the article, Soroka picks up fourth win in four starts. Well, we're coming up on 30 minutes past the hour. So we're going to move on over to the viewpoint section of the paper and read some opinion pieces. The first one is entitled, "Ending Birthright Citizenship Puts Our Families at Risk." Imagine waking up early on an April day in Arizona. The first thing you do is check on your phone, not to turn off the alarm this time, but to search frantically for "Where can I hear the oral arguments on birthright citizenship?" in Google. You've never been the person who wakes up to check the news. But this time, it's different. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on whether all babies born on U.S. soil should be citizens. And just like that, you are flooded with memories. Memories of reciting the Pledge of Allegiance every day at school, searching for the best 4th of July outfit, tearing up at a Suns game during the national anthem as the singer sang the words, "O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." As Arizonans continue to face the fundamental question of who gets to decide who is American, allow me to break out three reasons why ending birthright citizenship will take Arizona and the country in the wrong direction. The Solicitor General, who represents the position of the Trump administration, made the case that just being born on U.S. soil is not enough to become a citizen, but that the parents must have established a domicile and allegiance to the country. Now, this argument was strongly questioned by Justice Elena Kagan, as she highlighted the lack of textual evidence on this claim. Justice Amy Coney Barrett focused on two key questions. First, how would this work in real life? And second, how would one determine a parent's intent or status at birth? These questions showcase the impracticality and the administrative strain that it could create if the U.S. were to adopt the Trump administration's stance. Let's break it down. A woman is about to give birth, but she has a pending immigration petition for her legal permanent residency. Her water just broke, so she rushes to the hospital. Under this scenario, the hospital now would have to check the parent's immigration status. Hospital staff would have to handle more paperwork while trying to deliver a new life. It creates a lot of challenges for both the parents and the hospital, and leaves a newborn baby in legal limbo. For the past 150 years, the U.S.'s stance on birthright citizenship has been a simple and clear rule, according to the 14th Amendment and subsequent legal precedent. Changing it would mean more bureaucracy, confusion, and cost. Looking at our example, let's say that the hospital finds out the mom has a pending immigration petition, so the newborn will not be eligible for citizenship automatically. They would have to check if the father is a citizen. It creates a huge amount of confusion about tracking where a family is in the legal process, in addition to helping care for the new family. This could mean thousands of Arizona families will delay or potentially decide not to have a family, as this could punish families because of a government inefficiency processing immigration petitions. Why would we want to complicate something that already works? Solicitor General D. John Sauer says ending birthright citizenship will prevent birth tourism. That's in simple terms, preventing people from gaming the system to acquire citizenship by visiting the U.S. Chief Justice of the United States John Roberts asked for evidence of how common or significant birth tourism is. Sauer was unable to share a concrete answer. When Roberts moved to clarify that there was no clear legal analysis provided, Sauer said that travel is faster and we're in a new world now. To which the Chief Justice replied, "Well, it's a new world. It's the same Constitution." No one has a crystal ball, but one thing we can deduce from the oral arguments is that the court made it clear that while policy concerns are valid, they are not basis enough for constitutional interpretations. There are approximately 400,000 children who live with at least one foreign-born parent in Arizona. As a state, we should remain united that our government's role is to solve problems, not create new ones. Arizonans have long been clear that they want common-sense solutions, and American citizenship has been clearly defined by the Constitution for over 150 years. Let's ensure that U.S.-born babies are not starting their life in legal limbo. And that was the opinion piece, Ending Birthright Citizenship Puts Our Families at Risk. It was written by Reina Montoya. She is founder and CEO and board member of Aliento, serving students, dreamers, and immigrant families in Arizona. She is a regular contributor to the Republic Viewpoint section, and she serves on the Republic's Community Advisory Board. Our next opinion piece is entitled, Arizona ESAs Are Disgraceful. Stop the Nationwide Spread. Our next opinion piece is written by Senator Mark Kelly as a guest columnist. It's entitled, Arizona ESAs Are Disgraceful. Stop the Nationwide Spread. I'm a product of great public schools. I believe in the American dream because I lived it, and I know it starts with a good education. Every child in every zip code deserves a fair shot. That's not a policy position. It's an American value. But in Arizona, and increasingly across the country, universal school voucher programs are threatening that promise for millions of families. Arizona's experiment with universal school vouchers should be a cautionary tale for my Republican colleagues. It is busting our state budget and threatens to close public schools and make it harder for working-class kids to get a good education. We should not take Arizona's failed experiment national. But that is clearly what most congressional Republicans and the Trump administration did in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Since 2022, our state's universal voucher program has diverted and drained money from public schools. Last year alone, it cost Arizona taxpayers nearly $1 billion. Instead of investing in classrooms and special education services or school safety, lawmakers pushed massive tax giveaways and created a parallel education system that lacks transparency and accountability. Here's the truth. Most working families aren't benefiting, and the program is a magnet for waste, fraud, and abuse. The majority of voucher recipients in Arizona were already in private school before the program expanded. That means that taxpayers are now footing the bill, thousands of dollars per student, for families who were already paying private school tuition, and the wealthiest neighborhoods use the most vouchers. Taxpayers are essentially cutting blank checks for things that they have no business paying for. In March, the Arizona Attorney General's office released new data from an audit that examined a random sample of purchases from December 2024 through October 2025. The data showed that over 20% of purchases were identified as unallowed. Meanwhile, investigative reporters have found 18,000 parents spent over $10 million from the voucher program on things like diamond necklaces, cell phones, jet ski rentals, gaming consoles, a designer purse, Air Jordan sneakers, and hotel rooms. Families of students with disabilities are hit especially hard. Public schools are legally required to provide special education services under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Private schools are not. That means parents who depend on those protections are often left out entirely. Instead of addressing these problems, the Trump administration is doubling down. Trump's signature bill included a massive, deficit-increasing $26 billion national private school voucher program. We have an opportunity to fix this by passing the Keep Public Funds in Public Schools Act, which I introduced on April 15th. This bill, endorsed by more than 160 education and disability rights organizations, would repeal the federal tax credit voucher program, halting one of the major wrecking balls the Trump administration has taken to public education. America's public schools helped build the strongest middle class the world has ever seen. If we want to keep that dream alive and keep improving education, we must keep public funds in public schools that serve all kids. That's how we build our children's future and honor the American promise that hard work, not privilege, determines your path in life. It did it for me, and I want to make sure it does for every kid. Let's strengthen, not abandon, our public schools. Our kids and our country deserve it. And that was the opinion piece by Senator Mark Kelly entitled, Arizona ESAs Are Disgraceful. Stop the Nationwide Spread. Well, we're about coming up on 41 minutes past the hour, so let's read some opinions by people like you and me in the section of the paper called The Letters to the Editor. Our first letter to the editor goes like this. MAGA-supporting Christians must be feeling all tingly inside as their almighty leader threatened to wipe out a whole civilization in order to pressure Iran to open up the Strait of Hormuz. What better way to praise Jesus than to eliminate a good portion of planet Earth? If nothing else, it certainly lessens the competition in the world of religious dominance. It doesn't even matter that Trump has claimed we really don't need outside oil, but it just seems like the holy thing to do. Is this the bridge too far for so-called conservative Christians? Probably not. Most see it as typical Trump bluster and will rationalize his apocalyptic ranting as an appropriate demonstration of Trump's America and Christian first set of beliefs. I can picture it now. MAGA Christians bowing at the feet of America's new Lord and Savior. Signed, Robert Rosania in Scottsdale. Our next letter goes, listening to Donald Trump announcing that he will bomb all of Iran's civilian infrastructure or a whole civilization back to the Stone Age begs the question, is there any difference between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump? Putin is trying to bomb Ukraine into submission for their minerals, while Trump is doing the same for Iran's oil. Every American should be asking that question this coming November at the ballot box. Signed, Dan Copeland of Mesa. Next up, on April 7th, 2026, the entire world was held hostage and traumatized into thinking that the President of the United States might very well obliterate Iran by 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Regardless of your opinions about the war, think of the threat Trump made this way. Your home is invaded by a gunman. He holds your family hostage. He keeps a gun trained on your children. He says he plans to kill them by 8 p.m. You wait all day in terror. At 7:58 p.m., he changes his mind and lowers the gun. He expects to walk out the front door unhindered, a free man. The police arrive, and he's taken to jail, booked on kidnapping, attempted murder, and terrorist threats. Should he just be set free? Should we excuse him, since this is how this guy always behaves? After all, nobody died, but you and your family have been left permanently terrorized. Life will never be the same, despite the fact that nobody was actually killed. The gunman committed crimes against your family. He should be tried for his crimes. I believe Trump should be held accountable in the same way. Words matter. Threats matter. Trump's threats were beyond criminal, terrorized us all, and this country and the world will never be the same. Signed, Linda Furman in Peoria. Our next letter goes, the only positive news of last week was the fascinating round trip by the Artemis rocket launch of the Orion capsule and its successful return to Earth. The justification for travel to and around the moon 50 years after a robust NASA actually put several crews on the moon's surface is lost on me. The moon is an uninhabitable, rocky, pockmarked sphere, and the phenomenal photos of its surface prove that it has been struck at high velocity by millions of asteroids and meteors. Why does NASA intend to invest taxpayer funds to build an outpost on the moon, despite the reality that, without an Earth-like atmosphere to destroy a speeding meteor, anything built would be indefensible against an impending high-velocity strike? We have already landed robotic rovers and a helicopter on Mars' surface, and I would prefer that our $38 trillion in-debt government spend future funds to save the planet for our children and their children and their children. Signed, David Kahn of Scottsdale. And finally, the final letter. Earth Day on April 22nd highlights the urgent need for evidence-based solutions to the climate and ecological crisis. But what most people don't realize is the biggest impact we can make as individuals starts on our plates. Extensive research shows that animal agriculture is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, biodiversity loss, and freshwater depletion. In contrast, plant-based food systems require significantly fewer natural resources and generate lower emissions, making them a more efficient and sustainable way to feed a growing global population. Adopting plant-based meals, even incrementally, can substantially reduce one's environmental footprint while supporting a more resilient food system. This Earth Day, let's align our daily choices with science. By choosing more plant-based foods, we can actively contribute to climate mitigation, resource conservation, and a healthier planet. The data is clear, and so is the opportunity for meaningful change. Signed, Armando Reed in Phoenix. Well, we're at 46 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section and begin by reading today's horoscopes. We're going to begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. A light shines on what has value, so you can double down. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, step into your light with embodied confidence today. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, turn your energy inward. Embracing reflection can be illuminating. Slow down to receive your personal reset. For Cancer, June 22nd through July 22nd birth dates, dreams need structure now. Make sustainable progress toward the future you. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, consistency builds legacy. Put in the work. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, a transitional period ends. Shift your focus toward growth. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, you are more interested in reliability. Shift gears to calm, energetic exchanges. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, partnerships are ready to take center stage. Focus on all types of relationships, romantic, business, and collaborative. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, daily routines and wellness rituals come into the spotlight. Shape your routines. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th, make fun your first priority. Pleasure is not a distraction. It is the fuel for your vitality. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, home life, family ties, and emotional security become your primary focus. And finally, we have Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. Prepare for a packed schedule. While life speeds up, you may have to slow down. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Her first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, for the last 4 years, I have been hosting my son Dennis, his 6-year-old son, and his brother's 8-year-old daughter every other weekend. Dennis bought a puppy, Champ, to go with his house and brings him on these visits. Champ is nice enough, but extremely active. He runs wild and barks, digs holes, has never been trained. The grandkids are cousins, and they are thick as thieves. They love running around indoors and out, but I am worn out. This arrangement caused problems between Dennis and me because he is not as on top of managing Champ as he thinks he is. Also, I am the de facto dog watcher when Dennis has plans, and that's 4 or 5 times a year for 3 days to a week. I've told him more than once that he needs to get the animal trained or hire a sitter. And he has not. Dennis was going to take a car trip with his brother and sister-in-law and niece and his brother's dog. Because his brother wouldn't take two dogs, Dennis asked me to watch Champ, which I declined. I caught heck, and it was stressful, but I stuck to my guns. Wouldn't you know that Dennis will be in town helping his brother clear out a property for sale, and now he needs me to watch his dog for the weekend? Why is he asking me and putting me right back in the same position? Can you give me some insight? I will pass on the reply and follow your lead. Signed, Dogged in Washington. And Abby responds, Dear Dogged, your entitled son is conveniently ignoring the fact that his undisciplined animal is too much for you to handle because he doesn't like your message. He takes for granted that Mom won't stick to her guns. For the sake of your safety, please do not allow him to get away with it. Dennis is an irresponsible pet owner and too lazy to take his dog for obedience training. If he needs a pet sitter, he should hire one or board his dog at a kennel while he is away. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I know there can be regional differences in planning rehearsal dinners. Our son is getting married next year to a girl who lives about 4 hours from our home. The bride is insisting on having the rehearsal on Thursday and the rehearsal dinner on Friday, followed by a welcome party, which will be hosted by her friends. Every place we have suggested for the dinner has been tabled, pending the coordination of this welcome party. Further, the bride wants a large number of additional people to be added to the rehearsal dinner. Are my husband and I out of touch with the current view for wanting an intimate rehearsal dinner, including only the immediate family and those participating in the wedding? Signed, Groom's Mom in the South. And Abby responds, Dear Mom, according to Emily Post, the groom's parents traditionally host the rehearsal dinner, which includes the wedding party, young wedding party participant parents, the officiant and his or her spouse, and the couple's close relatives. According to Emily, you are not obligated to entertain out-of-town guests. Abigail Van Buren is the writer of Dear Abby. Abigail is also known as Janine Phillips, was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. You can contact Abigail two ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were our letters of advice. We turn now to some comic strips. In the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, Private Beetle is laying in his bunk in the barracks, and he thinks and smiles, and he thinks to himself, Ah, Sunday, the day of rest. In the next frame, my favorite day of the week. And then in the next frame, he's laid down and he cuddles his pillow and he says, Oh, I can sleep late. And then he thinks in the next frame, he can read the funnies in bed. He's so happy. And the next frame, Sergeant Snorkel's there and he says, Time to go. And Beetle says, Where? And in the last frame, Sergeant Snorkel's grabbed him by the arms and drug him out of bed and says, You promised the chaplain you'd help at the Sunday service. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then, for Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dag was at work, and he's in front of two machines, the Java self-serve coffee machine and the snack machine. And Dagwood's got a bill in his hand, and he's looking at. He looks like he's going to go into the snack machine, and one of his co-workers says, "Are you sure this will work, Dag?" And he goes, "I'm positive." And then he turns and says, "Here's your paddle, Dinwilder." "Thanks, Dag." Ah, who else but Dag would invent office pickleball? And Dagwood says, "It's easy. Just get a milk dud around with a plastic bottle." And then in the next frame, I invented a game too. Pin the tail on the worthless, no good employee. That's Mr. Dithers. Boy, everybody looks scared. And then Dagwood's back in the office and he says, "Jeesh, the old coot is getting too good at Photoshop." And off from the hallway, Mr. Dithers says, "I can hear you." And that was Blondie. And in Peanuts comic strip drawn featuring good old Charlie Brown by Schultz, there's Charlie Brown standing on the pitcher's mound. And Lucy comes right up to him and he says, "Now what are you doing?" And then he says in the next frame, "Get out there in right field and try to catch the ball." And then in the next frame he says, "And I don't want to hear any excuses today. Don't try to tell me that the sun is in your eyes, or the moon either, or the clouds, or the smog, or the crabgrass." And then she turns and starts to walk away, and he says, "And I don't want to hear about the ground moving, or your glove bending, or your shoes coming loose. All I want to see is that you caught the ball." In the next frame, he pitches. There it goes. The ball gets hit right up in the air. Charlie Brown looks out towards right field. The ball lands right in Lucy's glove. Plunk. She walks up to him, tosses it to him from the pitcher's mound right up to him. And he says, "Actually, I was kind of looking forward to a new excuse." And that was a comic strip, Peanuts, featuring good old Charlie Brown. Well, let's see who's having a birthday today. Congratulations to actress Eleanor Donahue. She turns 89 today. Tim Curry, the actor, turns 80. Tom Wood, the actor, turns 63. Ashley Judd turns 58. James Franco turns 48. Kate Hudson turns 47 today. And Ali Wong, the comedian and actress, turns 44. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You've been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 19th, 2026. Have a great day.